Support for this podcast and the following message come from Allianz Travel Insurance. An unexpected medical emergency can cost you. It can cost you even more when you're traveling abroad. Protect your trip at AllianzTravelInsurance.com.
Hey, Atlanta, it's Asma Khalid from the NPR Politics Podcast. We are going to be live on stage doing our show Thursday, October 20th at 8 p.m. at the Buckhead Theater. And we'd love for you to be there. Ticket info is at nprpresents.org. Thanks to our partners, Georgia Public Broadcasting, WABE, and WCLK Jazz. See you there.
Hey there, it's the NPR Politics Podcast. I'm Susan Davis. I cover politics.
And I'm Domenico Montanaro, senior political editor and correspondent.
And it's 10:04 a.m. on Friday, September 30th. We're focusing on Hurricane Ian and its devastation through much of Florida this week. Communities across the state are figuring out just how much damage has been done. Recovery efforts are expected to cost tens of billions of dollars. NPR's Greg Allen is in Florida. Hey, Greg.
Hello.
So, talk us through this. Which areas of the state were hit hardest by the hurricane?
Well, you know, this hurricane was so large that it affected almost all of Florida in one way or the other. The main impact, of course, has been on the Gulf Coast from Naples all the way up to St. Petersburg. And all those areas felt some impact. The greatest impact, of course, is in Lee County, where Fort Myers is, and Charlotte County. Port Charlotte is the main city there. And when the storm came in, it brought this huge storm surge, and it just devastated the islands, the barrier islands there, and it flooded many other communities on shore. And the wind did a lot of damage. In some communities, we've seen almost every house damaged. Here's what Governor DeSantis has to say about it.
To see a house just sitting in the middle of Estero Bay literally was have gotten picked up, flown because of the massive wind speed and the storm surge, and deposited in a body of water. There was cars floating in the middle of the water.
And the biggest issues really are the infrastructure going out to the islands. Sanibel Island, Fort Myers Beach, and Pine Island all have bridges that have been declared unsafe or are totally out.
There's been a lot of reports of people without power, obviously loss of homes. How many people are being impacted by this right now?
Well, like I say, it's almost the entire state, although, you know, in some places, South Florida didn't get too much. But as the storm went through the state, it flooded many areas in Central Florida and in Northwest Florida. So it's hard to put a number on it. You know, you've got to put it in the millions. And we're a state of some 20 million plus. And so you've got to say probably at least a third of this had some significant impacts from this. And of course, the main impacts have been the loss of power for many people and flooding in these most affected areas.
Domenico, when states have this level of devastation, there almost has to be a federal government response. How has the Biden administration been dealing with this?
Yeah, and we heard DeSantis allude to that yesterday, talking about how there would be federal money, even though he was also touting the fact that because of his economic policies, there's a surplus in the state so that they're pretty well positioned. But, you know, even though President Biden and Governor DeSantis couldn't have more different politics. I mean, these are two people who don't appear to like each other very much. DeSantis doesn't particularly like Biden. You know, he's talked, made a, basically his entire reelection campaign in many respects about how he would do things differently than Biden. And we know he has presidential aspirations, DeSantis. But this is a time when, you know, the federal and state coordination has to be of the utmost priority because these are people's lives at stake. And this is when politics is supposed to work well and at its best, where you kind of get rid of the silliness of politics and deal with the seriousness of it, you know, to be able to have government help people's lives. And I talked to Professor Andrew Reeves at Washington University in St. Louis, who actually researches storm politics.
Oh,
he was saying that there are really a lot of incidents in which, you know, presidents and local officials can be helped by these kinds of storms because they look like leaders, or they can be hurt if they kind of mismanage a recovery.
If things go very bad, you know, if the fallout from this storm is food can't get delivered and electricity takes forever to get restored, well, there could be a backlash. But right now, I think, it's sort of like leadership on display from these politicians. And that is potentially a good thing for their electoral fortunes.
Well, that brings to mind the question of Governor DeSantis, Greg. I mean, he is someone who certainly most recently has been governing from a very partisan posture. I wonder, obviously, long recovery ahead, but how has he been approaching this crisis? Is there something to say about his leadership style in this moment?
It's like there's two Governor DeSantis's. The one that we've gotten used to over the last year and a half, 2 years, has been this partisan one who attacks the Biden administration at every stop. When the hurricane hit and the lead up to the storm, suddenly we got back to the Ron DeSantis that we saw when he was first took office after being inaugurated, where he basically talked about just being a good governor and responding to emergencies. The first emergency he responded to here was Hurricane Michael up in the Panhandle right after he took office, and he made that kind of a hallmark of his early administration. He's back to that, Ron DeSantis. He's holding briefings several times a day. He's on the media everywhere, and he's actually shown a very gubernatorial style. Now, the question is, going forward, will that help him or not? And I think the professor who mentioned, you know, potential problems is on to something. You know, Florida has this looming insurance crisis, and you've got a lot of people here whose homes were devastated and who might not have the flood coverage they need to pay for it. So all these are issues that could come to the fore over the next month or two. We'll see if it has how Governor DeSantis handles it and how it affects his political chances.
Sure. I mean, and obviously he's talked about in the 2024 context, but he's also on the ballot this November. He's running for re-election as governor, and he's in, you know, at least a seemingly competitive race based off of public polling.
Yeah, that's what makes this a lot different. You wind up with an election that's happening within weeks of when this storm hits, and the recovery is really the big piece of any, you know, political fortunes of somebody who, you know, is dealing with the management of a storm. It's far too early to know right now in this moment whether or not this helps or hurts DeSantis or even Biden.
Greg, back to the people of Florida. What needs to happen in the coming days in terms of the recovery effort, and what are you watching?
Well, right now, I mean, some of the big issues are these major infrastructure issues. There's this major water main break in Lee County that's affected a lot of people there. So if you don't have running water, that's almost more important than power in recovering from a hurricane. And so that's important. And then, as we mentioned earlier, getting people on those barrier islands, those are economic engines here, Sanibel and Fort Myers Beach. That's where all the money comes from tourism. So that those have to be rebuilt, and it's going to take some time just to get the bridges back, and then there's lots of other devastation there. So those are going to be the biggest needs economically for individuals, getting your power back, your water back, and that's happening actually at a decent pace, except for, you know, the infrastructure issue with the water main that I mentioned.
Domenico, it used to be the norm when a state, any state, faced this kind of destruction, Congress would pass emergency funding to help the state in need. And it used to be the sort of bipartisan norm of Washington. That's not the case anymore. We've seen in recent years emergency spending, even hurricane spending, has become much more polarized. Do you anticipate that that could happen again, or is it different this time?
Well, it was bipartisan until the Tea Party. I mean, let's be frank, that's what happened in 2010 or thereabouts after that. It became really a cause to say, you know, there's too much spending on a credit card, quote unquote, and that's why the federal debt is as high as it is. And guess who felt that way not too long ago was now Governor Ron DeSantis. Back in 2013, he voted against funding for recovery for Sandy, for example, the superstorm in New York, New Jersey, and much of the East Coast. He had a very different vote when there was a hurricane that affected Florida and then Texas during the Trump administration a few years ago, and voted in favor of it. Maybe it's because we're further from the kind of Tea Party politics of that kind of federal debt focus, but that's something that has started to bubble up again as people look to, you know, toward DeSantis's reelection and things to sort of use against him. But it is a fact that this has become a way more partisan issue, and all on the Republican side.
All right. NPR's Greg Allen, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome.
And Domenico, we'll let you go too.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break and we'll be back in a second.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu. Support for NPR and the following message come from Washington Wise. Decisions made in Washington can affect your portfolio every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab that unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how it may affect your finances and portfolio. Listen at schwab.com/Washington Wise.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back with White House correspondent Franco Ordonez and politics reporter Ximena Bustillo. Hey, guys.
Hey. Hi.
And Ximena, we should note, first time on the podcast.
It is.
Welcome, welcome.
Yeah, first time for everything.
Well, you're here today because President Biden, earlier this week, held a conference on hunger at the White House. He pushed for Congress to do things like permanently extend the child tax credit, raise the minimum wage, and expand nutrition assistance programs. So you covered this event. What was the driving force behind it?
President Biden had 3 months to put together a hunger conference that really focused on finding solutions to ending hunger in America by the year 2030. And he put out a 44-page plan on how he wanted to do that and got groups, whether they were regular people, advocates, lobbyists, and members from agencies at this conference to talk about some of those solutions. We saw during the pandemic that government assistance really helped to keep hunger rates down.
Yeah.
And also, 1 in 10 Americans at the same time still face hunger every single day. So even though government assistance is helping, people are still going hungry at the end of the day.
Can you talk about sort of the scope of the problem of hunger in America, especially with a lot of these programs expiring soon, or if they haven't already expired?
Yeah, so a lot of that pandemic aid is coming to an end and will definitely come to an end whenever the emergency declaration is lifted eventually. Again, 1 in 10 Americans faces food insecurity every day. That's about 34 million Americans, according to USDA, and that can range, you know, that can be children, that can be families. At the same time, though, we are also seeing this focus on health and diet-related diseases. And what was seen during the pandemic is people that have diet-related diseases like diabetes, hypertension, heart diseases, they were more likely to experience more severe symptoms and even hospitalization and death because of COVID. And that is something that other countries have acknowledged and have, you know, begun to address hunger and diet-related diseases, nutrition access, right? This idea of nutrition security, not just food security. But the United States hasn't quite done that. Food policy is still on the back burner.
Franco, I mean, the timing of this is interesting to me because we're weeks before a midterm. This is a very known problem. It's like, why the interest now? Why haven't Democrats been talking about this for a long time?
Yeah, I do. I find it interesting because they've been talking about a really ambitious game, talking about ending hunger by 2030. Yet, you know, when it comes to execution, it doesn't seem like they've really been putting kind of the muscle behind it that they have behind other issues. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's kind of led to some of this partisan talk, saying this is more of raising Democratic interests before the midterms. Ximena can talk better about this, but I mean, planning was kind of rushed together. They were only putting out some of these invites weeks before this were to go around. And the reality is that Republicans, while they support a lot of the ideas behind this, they're not so behind and they oppose some of the recommendations or how they will be actually carried out, how they will be paid for. I mean, even Republicans involved in the issue were complaining that this was partisan.
But Jimena, is it partisan? I mean, I think of food policy. A lot of Republicans represent really poor districts where people need a lot of food assistance. A lot of Republicans represent ag states mm-hmm. that care a lot about these programs. I mean, this does seem like there is an issue where you could find some honest players willing to find bipartisan solutions.
Right, absolutely. And even on the Hill, the Senate and House Agriculture Committees like will at any moment they can say that they are the most bipartisan committees.
Yeah, the Farm Bill tends to be a big bipartisan effort.
Yeah, and they do. You know, they do try to pass everything together, which has been very interesting to watch compared to other committees. But again, it really comes down to the money and how much money is being allocated into some of these programs. I don't think anyone's necessarily saying that hunger is good or people need to experience hunger in order to, you know, pull themselves up. However, there is an issue about like how much money gets allocated to some of these programs. Expanding SNAP is expensive. Universal school meals are expensive. And that's where that line gets drawn.
So what exactly is expiring? Like what is this is a big issue that needs to be solved in a lot of ways, but there are short term programs that are basically just going to cease to exist soon.
Sort of, yeah. There were a couple flexibilities to SNAP and the Women, Infants, and Children program that are on the verge of expiring, which are programs that specifically help families and children access food and be able to purchase food when they otherwise might not be able to. At the same time, there have been some expansions recently made that will eventually come to an end. There's kind of this idea of a cliff that's eventually going to happen. We saw universal school meals that were in place for the last 2 years just come to an end as soon as this new school year started. And that's a cliff that many parents are experiencing right now. Stimulus checks, child tax credit, all of that already faded out. So we're seeing less assistance than we have the last 2 years. And it's that idea of a cliff that has a lot of advocates really worried that even though we haven't seen hunger rates increase in the last 2 years, we might this year.
It also seems a lot less likely if one or both chambers of Congress flip in 7-8 weeks mm-hmm. that next year President Biden is probably not that something couldn't get done, but you're going to have less willing partners, at least in terms of how you pay for this stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look at the leaders of the Republican Party who are part of these committees that are involved with this, whether it's the Agriculture Committee or the Education and Labor Committee. Both of the leaders on the Republican side were complaining that the conference that Jimena was at was partisan and, you know, really critical of the administration for what they saw as seeing it as a political event.
This is also an issue that the president has been focused on in sort of the global stage as well, isn't it?
Yeah, when President Biden spoke to the UN General Assembly last week, this was a very big issue. And there's a lot of pressure on the Biden administration to do more for hunger globally. And that's been exacerbated by the war in Ukraine. Part of the push for getting more done for global hunger is trying to isolate Russia. And how they're doing that is because many of the countries who are most affected by the needs of hunger, by the food security problems, happen to be countries in the global south, they say, many in South America, Africa, which also happen to be countries who have not taken sides in the war, who have not, you know, gone against Russia for economic reasons, for food security reasons, for geopolitical reasons. So what Biden has been basically doing is essentially going to these countries and telling them, look, we want to work on these issues with you. We want to work on the issues that are important to you. But at the same time, you got to come over and kind of follow some international norms to do that, which he means, you know, going against Putin.
So regardless of what happens in the congressional elections at this summit, what were the policy ideas on the table? Like, what are they saying that needs to be done? And is there any hope that it can be done either by Congress or potentially by executive action?
Right. So there are 44 pages of recommendations, and they are divided up into what Congress can do, what agencies in the administration can do by itself, and then also very particularly what private companies can do and kind of more of a public-private partnership approach to solving hunger, you know, at a local level. Now, in terms of what Congress can do, that's everything that you mentioned off the top, you know, increasing the minimum wage, a child tax credit, expanding SNAP and nutrition assistance programs. Now, there are things that the administration can sort of do itself, but that will also take time and is limiting. There are no necessarily executive orders that have been announced or that have been put out, but they want to do things like change labels on food products mm-hmm. to maybe make them more easier for people to understand what it is that they're eating. So putting them on the front instead of the back. Again, these rules and regulations would be coming out of the FDA, and that takes a really long time.
Really long time, yeah.
And then there's the idea of private companies.
Sure.
And so we saw about $8 billion worth of promises or commitments, they're called, were put out by dozens of private companies. And I'm talking like fitness companies, food companies like Tyson and Smithfield. They, you know, vowed to look at how they were going to look at promotions or how they were going to look at their programs. I talked to the Tyson folks, and they specifically have a program where they have grants for food banks to be able to buy bigger freezers or bigger compartments to store more food. And they donate a lot of their protein to food banks as well. And they want to grow and expand that as well. So definitely a mix.
Jimena, can I just ask you, I mean, do the people that live and breathe this on a day-to-day basis, I mean, what do they feel about what the White House is doing? Do they feel that the White House is putting putting its back into it? Or do they see it as, you know, another, you know, political move before the midterms?
Yeah, the people in the space, I think, are very passionate about it. Food is a very personal thing, and what you can eat, what you have access to, is very, very personal. So the fact that this conference was held was a good first step for a lot of folks. It was almost a sense of an olive branch to groups that have been, you know, paying attention to this, especially during a pandemic where food and access to food was such a big deal. However, it, like you said, the planning did feel really rushed to a lot of folks.
A little partisan,
yeah. Right? Very, very little GOP representation at the conference itself. And the GOP representation that was there did not talk about legislative action. It's also a situation where I think some folks were hoping Biden would come out with some sort of an executive order or some sort of immediate rollout of money. And we just did not see that.
All right, let's take a quick break. And when we get back, it's time for Can't Let It Go.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth/whatsyourwhy. Support for this podcast and the following message come from the United States Postal Service. Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping services? Then give your business a competitive edge with USPS Ground Advantage. Keep things simple with upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. Turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, I mean, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
And we're back, and it's time to end the show like we do every week with Can't Let It Go, the part of the show where we talk about the things from the week we can't stop talking about, politics or otherwise. I'm going to go first this week. The thing I can't let go of is the still ongoing scandal surrounding former NFL star Brett Favre and the scandal in Mississippi where top political officials were involved in essentially, allegedly, stealing funds from the welfare program for poor families and redirecting them to any number of pet causes, including a volleyball stadium at a local Mississippi university. But the thing about this that I can't let go is that the story was basically exposed by a very small news outlet called Mississippi Today and a young reporter named Anna Wolf, who I have discovered just in the course of the past week. But I can't let it go because I think it's such a great tale of local journalism doing the local journalism thing and exposing this like really big, important story. And it reminded me of years ago when another young female reporter exposed the scandal at Penn State, the Sandusky scandal there. And
Sarah Gannon,
right? And it's just, to me, I can't let it go because it has actually been, again, like it's a sad story. It's a story of government malfeasance and corruption. But I think there's also like a positive in this story that
the
it's
importance
like,
of local journalism.
Yeah,
like,
and
yeah.
Like a young reporter, like and I listened. She did a really long interview this week with WMU's 1A, where she talked about what it took to get this story, and it was, you know, years of trying to get government documents and knocking on doors, and just that sort of reporting that is like the thing Hollywood movies are made out of, right? And like you're seeing the fruit of all that labor right now. It's a big, important story to the state of Mississippi. It's exposing all kinds of things. It will probably help poor people in the long run. And it's like a feel-good story about journalism, right?
Yeah.
Like it's
there's so much
media criticism and culture and all of that. And it's like, no, this one is like, this is a great story of local journalism and what
and
it can
she's
do.
Like getting seen for it too.
Yes.
Like not necessarily like a personality, but people are reading what she wrote, which
yeah.
You know, sometimes I feel like I write things and no one sees them ever.
Right. And it's like a small nonprofit newsroom, like churning out stories, but it's like doing really important work. And it just made me feel good this week. It was the thing that made me feel good about the world this week. Franco, what can't you let go of?
What I can't let go is, I don't know if you guys have heard, or maybe you're into, maybe you guys are players, is about pickleball, is that LeBron James.
I've heard of him. I'm familiar.
Every now and then.
Well, you may not know, but he has purchased a professional pickleball team with a few other NBA stars, including Kevin Love and Draymond Green from the Golden State Warriors. But they have purchased a professional pickleball team. First of all, I didn't even know there were professional leagues of pickleball. I thought it was just...
Pickleball, it's like a form of tennis, right? It's like tennis-like.
It's like a small form of tennis. Like some people compare it to between a large ping pong and small tennis. Obviously, it's played like on a court.
Yeah,
it is all the rage. A lot of people are doing. A lot of people like to do it because it's a little less stressful on the bones. Even our producer was recommending that I start playing pickleball instead of playing soccer because each time I come after a soccer game, I complain of a different injury. And I hate to say it. Probably
you can pickleball your whole life, I guess. Is that does the pickleball team have a name?
I do not know of a name yet, or at least I have not seen it in these reports, but I will get back to you on that.
Ximena, what can't you let go of this week?
My can't let go is Lizzo.
Absolutely. I knew
rocking
was gonna be Lizzo
on that flute,
yeah.
You know, earlier this week. And not only did she bring out James Madison's old flute from the depths of D.C., but she played it in concert and played it in the Congressional Library, I believe.
Yeah.
And really rocked it. You know, I didn't know this about Lizzo, but she has been a flautist for a
classically
very
trained
long time.
Yeah.
Maybe I was behind on that Lizzo fact. There's so many about her. But, I mean, it's a gorgeous flute. It's a crystal flute. And it was gifted to James Madison for his second inauguration.
I think I would have been terrified to handle something like that.
To drop it?
I think
nails are so beautiful and long. And she just
played it. They handed it to her and she like played it in concert. Then I think they had like security there to like take it right back. It's
she like a baby, like very.
But
quickly.
If I went to the Library of Congress and they're like, "Hey, do you want to hold this glass flute?" I'd be I'm good.
No.
I'm gonna
absolutely
drop James Madison's flute. I'm gonna ruin it.
I'm gonna blink at it and it's gonna crack. Yeah.
Honestly, a glass flute sounds better than I would think a glass instrument would sound.
I know. I had never thought about a flute being made out of crystal glass, but it's gorgeous.
All right. I think that is a wrap for today. Our executive producer is Muthoni Muturi. Our editor is Eric McDaniel. Our producers are Casey Morell and Alina Moore. Thanks to Christian Dev Kalamer, Brandon Carter, Maya Rosenberg, and Lexi Schapittel. I'm Susan Davis. I cover politics.
I'm Ximena Bustillo, and I also cover politics.
And I'm Frank Ordonez. I cover the White House.
And thanks for listening to the NPR Politics Podcast.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch. Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.